Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Creekside Room are Rosie and Jonathan Betzal, and they will be speaking on Peace Heroes in Song and Story. So let's listen in on Rosie and Jonathan.
I'm Rosie Betzal, this is my husband Jonathan, and we, in our lives, one of the things that we try to do is follow the precept of Jesus about peacemaking. And I've always been inspired when I hear stories of other people that are doing any kind of peacemaking, the small daily acts of courage, as Lech Walesa, that Polish solidarity guy, says. And so I wanted to make a program that would be both, that would be real life stories of people who do extraordinary things, or we think of them as extraordinary, but actually they're just the courageous things that they're led to do. So, since we don't have any little kids, I won't put the disclaimer of how scary this first story is on. But no one does end up getting hurt. This is a story about, can I have a purple sheet? Is that around anywhere? Purple sheet's missing. Yes, that's it. Turned white. Okay. About Louise, Nathan, and Riley, people who lived in North Carolina. And it was probably just this year or last year. But Louise and Nathan are two grandparents. And one day they got up because their cat was meowing and it wanted to be let out in the morning. So they woke up and got up. The cat went out on the porch and it started to hiss. And it made itself into double the size that it usually is. And so Nathan, the dad, went out and said, "Cat, what's up with you?" And suddenly a man stepped out from behind the corner of their house with a gun in his hand. And before they knew it, Louise and Nathan were shoved up. They realized that Riley, this man, was one of the three people who had escaped from prison a couple days earlier near their town. But Louise, instead of screaming and crying, she stood her ground and she said, "I am a Christian lady and I don't allow no violence around here. Put that gun down, young man." And what do you know? He looked around and put the gun down on the sofa. And then he said to them, "I am so hungry. I haven't eaten in 3 days." And she said, "Well, young man, sit right down at the kitchen table and I will make you breakfast. And Nathan, go get that boy some new dry socks." So that's what she proceeded to do. She sat down, or went to the kitchen where Riley was sitting, and she made him a big breakfast of bacon and eggs and toast and coffee. And she put her best napkins on the table and called Nathan in, and they all sat down to breakfast. So, and she took Riley's hand as they sat down at breakfast and prayed. She said, "I am so glad that God brought you to this house where you'll be safe. And that God loves you very much." And then they ate a great breakfast. And after breakfast, she continued to pray with Riley. Let's see, she said things, in fact, I have her exact words. She said, "Young man, I love you and God loves you. God loves us all, every one of us, especially you. Jesus died for you because he loves you so much." And this, Riley said, "You remind me of my grandmother. She's dead." And he actually cried a tear, this criminal from the prison. And then, as they were still praying, they heard the police cars drive up. And so Riley started to get really, really agitated and said, "I know they're going to kill me. They're going to kill me when they come in here." And so Louise said to him, "Don't you worry. You are safe here. You let me do the talking." So he sat there, and Louise went out on the front porch and yelled at the police. They had come out of their cars with their guns out. And she said, "Y'all know that I don't let no violence happen around here, and I want you to put your guns away. Nathan, and we'll bring Riley out any minute after you put your guns away." So, those policemen put their guns away in the car. Nathan, her husband, brought Riley out, and he was sent back to prison without any violence at all. And I think that that woman really, really studied that song. You don't have song books, do you? She studied that song that was part of Southern culture and is still part, and a wonderful song from here. And it's the study born of war.
Page 112, last one.
Yeah, so you're going to play that, right?
Yep. So the other half of this workshop is thinking the song. So we would like you to sing along with us. Some of the musical arrangements in here are a little different than the way we sing them. So we'd all like to sing our way.
Yeah. So the book is mainly for the words.
I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside, down by the riverside. It took about 80 years for the black people's resistance to this to really start to take hold. And this story, in some ways, is the culmination of a lot of people's hard work over the years. And I think the story will actually bring that out. On December 1st, 1955, Rosa Parks, who worked as a seamstress in a downtown department store, was riding home on a Montgomery, Alabama city bus, sitting toward the front of a section for blacks. The buses were divided in half. The back section was for the blacks and the front was for the whites. And in fact, black people had to get out the front, pay, get off, and get on again at the back. They weren't allowed to walk through the white section. Anyway, she was sitting in the front of the black section. But when the white section filled up, the driver, as was required by law, then asked her to get up and move so white people could continue to fill up the black section as they moved toward the back of the bus. This was the law. That's what she was supposed to do. Well, Mrs. Parks was tired that day. She and
Incidentally, this is a less well-known part of the story. She had also been quite active in the civil rights struggle in very quiet ways. But she refused to get up. She later said her feet were tired. She did not want to stand. She'd been working all day long, you know. She didn't want to have to stand in the back of the bus. So the driver called the cops and had her arrested, and she went to jail. In fact, here's a photo of her getting fingerprinted. They actually took pictures of it. I
guess she was about 58 then?
No, she was younger.
She was younger?
She was younger. I've actually met her. She's now about, this is, you know, 35 years ago. She's now about 80. So however old that makes her. Anyway, but she had been the secretary of E.D. Nixon, who was a union official. And she called up her former boss to come and bail her out of jail. The next morning, her former boss went to the local civil rights group. I'm sorry, went to Ralph Abernathy, who was the pastor of the First Baptist Church of Montgomery, to suggest a one-day boycott of city buses. Abernathy agreed, and the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., who was then the pastor of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, made his church basement available for a meeting that evening to discuss the boycott proposal. About 40 black community leaders attended and endorsed the plan for a one-day boycott on the day of Rosa Parks' trial. Black taxi companies agreed to help by carrying boycotters for 10 cents, the normal bus fare. Taxi drivers,
yeah.
Yes.
We carry the white?
No, they carry the black people for 10 cents, the normal bus fare.
Because the black people would be on the buses.
Right. Blacks distributed leaflets explaining the boycott throughout their communities, and the conservative Montgomery Advertiser inadvertently helped by printing a leaflet on its front page. On Sunday morning, every black pulpit in town sounded the call for the boycott. When King drove around town Monday morning from 6 to 7, when buses were normally packed, he saw only 8 blacks riding them. The boycott was a success. Now that they knew that the boycott could be used in this way, the black leaders formed the Montgomery Improvement Association and elected King as the president. He was young, he was new in town.
Only
he was
26 years
26,
old.
26 years old, new in town. He wasn't a member of any of the existing factions in the community, so he was an obvious compromise president. And besides, he had a lot of energy, and they liked that idea. So they decided to continue the boycott so as to win some relief from the racist city ordinance. The goal was modest, not complete integration, but only a more flexible color line. People would be seated on a first-come, first-served basis, with blacks filling seats from the rear forward and whites filling seats from the front back. But the bus company and the city refused to relax their policies at all. So they continued the boycott for several months, and things really heated up. Any of you who've seen the movie Driving Miss Daisy? It was about that very time in Montgomery, Alabama. It's actually told from a white person's point of view, so it's not, you know, not entirely the point of view that we want to express, but it showed what it took for white people to get involved in that struggle. You know, a few did. Anyway, the boycott continued, and it became quite a national cause celebrity because it went on for so long. The civil rights people called on their allies from around the country, and people started to come and really pay attention to what was happening in Selma. It took about a year, and in fact, the economics started to build up pressure almost right away. Since 65% of the bus company's riders had been black, the company was forced to raise fares and cut schedules. Downtown stores were also losing business because fewer blacks were going downtown to shop. When the bus company decided it would grant the Montgomery Improvement Association's demands that the city would repeal the segregation ordinance, the white businessmen in town decided to support that effort. They asked the city council to repeal the ordinance and allow the buses to be desegregated completely. It was only the white mayor, who was a member of the White Citizens Council, who said he didn't care if a black ever rode a bus again. But we all know the end of the story. It took about a year, but finally the city council did cave in, especially under this economic pressure, and the battle was won. But it took one person. It took Rosa Parks refusing to get up in the face of first the bus driver, all the other passengers glaring at her, and of course the police, demonstrating courage in the face of all that to spark the successful struggle. And as you also know, that led to quite a wave of other kinds of civil rights struggles, and we'll talk about that next.
What happened at her trial?
She was fined some minimal amount, and the Montgomery Improvement Association paid the fine.
Well, the song that we'd like to do with that one is one you probably don't know. It's on page 68. It's called Back of the Bus. It was written later by another woman who was in jail, probably during the voting rights. Or the school? Voting rights.
Yeah. For the sake of the tape, let's identify this book. This is called Children's Songs for a Friendly Planet. This was put out several years ago by the National Council of Churches.
If you miss me from the back of the bus and you can't find me nowhere, come on up to the front of the bus. I'll be riding up there. I'll be riding up there. I'll be riding up there. Come on up to the front of the bus. I'll be riding up there. If you miss me on the back of the bus, you can't find me nowhere. Come on up to the driver's seat. I'll be driving up there. 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 If you miss me from the cotton fields, you can't find me nowhere. Come on over to the high school. I'll be studying there. I'll be studying there. I'll be studying there. Come on over to the high school. I'll be studying there. If you miss me from the back of the bus, you can't find me nowhere. Come on up to the front of the bus. I'll be riding up there. I'll be riding up there. I'll be riding up there. Come on up to the front of the bus. I'll be riding up there.
Okay.
All right. This next story that we have is also about the civil rights movement that was here in America. We think that this was during the voting rights campaign.
This must have been voting rights.
Yeah. You know, it's really, really hard to believe that American citizens are capable of so much violence to the other citizens in this country. And hopefully it will diminish as time goes on. But in the days of the civil rights movement, feelings really ran high and people really felt free to beat each other up if they wanted to have their way. Except, you know, with Martin Luther King's principles of nonviolence and the way that the black people took on those principles, there wasn't that much black violence against white folks. It was mostly the other way around. One day in, let's see, what town is this? In Selma, Alabama. Was it Selma again? Yeah, I think so. There was a rally going on. A lot of black and white activists were there near a Baptist church. And at that moment, a black funeral director from Montgomery drove up to them and reported a story that he had witnessed in Montgomery.
This is several hundred miles away.
Several hundred miles away. He had seen a student demonstration surrounded by police horses. And it was so surrounded that no one could get away. And the police, instead of giving them a way to leave, said, now that you're surrounded, they didn't say that, but they were surrounded. They said, everybody disperse. But no one could leave because they couldn't get under the horses. And they said, and instead, when the people didn't disperse, they rode in and beat people up. And they even prevented ambulances from coming for 2 whole hours after they had beaten people up. So you can imagine the feelings of the people several hundred miles away when they heard this terrible story of violence. But right then, a young minister stepped up to the microphone and he said, "People, I think it's time we had a song." And he began to sing this song. Now, I don't know the song, but I think it probably went something like this. "Do you love Martin King?" And everybody sang, "Certainly, Lord. Do you love Martin King? Certainly, 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 Lord." And so he went down the whole row of all the leaders of the civil rights movement, Reverend Abernathy, everybody else in turn. And the crowd just sang because they did love these people. And then, all of a sudden, without any warning, he sang the name of the sheriff in their town who had been doing terrible things like hosing school children down with fire hoses. You could really get hurt when you're hit with the fire hose water.
And setting dogs on people.
And this minister sang, "Do you love Sheriff Jim Clark?" There was a little hesitation, but people sang, "Certainly, Lord. Do you love Sheriff Jim Clark? Certainly, 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 Lord." And he sang it again. "Do you love Jim Clark? Certainly, 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 Lord." And the people realized what they were saying and that is the way they should feel, even toward Sheriff Jim Clark. And then another man, another reverend, Reverend James Bevel, got up, and this is what he said. "We are not just fighting for our rights. We are fighting for the good of the whole society. It's not enough to defeat Jim Clark. Do you hear me, Jim?" And I'm sure Jim heard about it, because that was his town. And I'm sure his police guys were nearby. And they reported to him what happened. "We want you converted, Jim. We cannot win by hating our oppressors. We have to love them into changing." And with the strength of those people, Jim Clark did change. When the voting rights were given back to black folks, Jim knew as an elected official that he would never, never be elected sheriff again if he didn't win the black vote. So he began courting black voters. And after a while, I think quite sincerely, he said that he had been wrong in his bias against black people. When he got to know them, when he realized through knowing them that they were like him. And if those people in Selma and in Montgomery hadn't taken the violence onto their own bodies and refused to give it back, well, what they did by doing that, by taking it and not giving the violence back, is they stopped that cycle of violence. And that is, it's just an amazing, amazingly courageous thing to do, especially when the effects are not immediate. And I think, and one of the songs that they sang a lot, and still gets sung today, is "Oh Freedom." It was originally sung right after emancipation by people who had been freed and they were never going to go back to being slaves. But it's had to be sung ever since as a hope that all these laws that were passed taking away civil rights people would eventually get their rights again. So, John, you lead this?
You're
good. We're going to do verse 1, 3, and 4.
Okay.
Can I get it first? Thanks.
Yeah.
we moved to San Francisco, we got involved in a number of different projects with the American Friends Service Committee, and one January we got called, asked to provide nonviolence training for a group of people who are involved in a housing struggle. These people were primarily elderly, retired Chinese and Filipino-American seamen, retired seamen, who were living in what's called a single residence occupancy hotel, or SRO hotel. These are present, or were present, in many the downtowns of many American cities, especially seaports like San Francisco was. And they formed quite a community among themselves. They were retired, they got to see a lot of each other, they played games together, and they were really quite good friends.
Their kitchens were like a couple rooms on each floor that had hot plates and refrigerators.
And shared bathrooms, much like the situation in Holden, yes. So they had built up quite a community. Well, about 8 years prior to this, the building was sold to a company called Four Seas, which was essentially a holding or a front, an American legal front for the liquor godfather of Thailand. There had been a student revolution in Thailand, and this one guy wanted to get his money out of the country, so he set up this corporation to buy San Francisco real estate, and among other things, he bought this rundown SRO hotel where these people were living. And right away, he wanted to tear it down and build a parking lot because he'd make a lot more money that way. Well, the people in the apartment building had such a good community, they decided they did not want to move, and that became their slogan, "We won't move." So for 8 years, they built up a support community of outside people who were helping them, were providing them with all kinds, especially legal support and all the court battles that they went through.
Yeah, housing in many big cities, San Francisco in particular, is very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys had their tiny seamen's pensions, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right. So for 8 years they've been fighting eviction, and finally all the legal channels of appeal were exhausted in this January. They knew they were going to have to take a whole other tax, so they brought in somebody who we knew from other places, who was going to organize them to do a nonviolent resistance campaign. This person, I don't know whether she was actually involved in the civil rights movement, but certainly trained by people who were, as we were too. So she brought us in to be her assistants, basically, and help just with the training part itself. So we ended up doing a lot of different things. We really learned, among other things, we learned how to be servants of people of color. One thing that was not too hard for us. We never lived in the South or any place where there were where we would have had a strong go against the teachings of our society, particularly. It was relatively easy for us. But I imagine other people would have had a harder time. But we helped organize and run the night patrols that kept an eye on things and made sure no arsonists showed up in the night to try and burn the place down. Because that's what the threat had, in fact, been made, that they would do that. But over those months, we got to meet a lot of the other supporters of the hotel. It was a real mixed bag of people. There was a strong contingent of a group called BAGL, Bay Area Gay Liberation. So I met my first black gay activists there. Very interesting folks. A lot of them were musicians, which gave us a lot of interesting things to talk about. You're sitting on fire watch at night, and there's not a whole lot to do. So you kind of converse about your life and so on. And I met other gay activists too, and I hadn't known, I kind of decided with gay liberation before that. After that, I was very strongly in favor of it because these great people I met. But probably the single biggest contingent of people, aside from middle class do-gooders like us, was the young Filipino Americans. We got to know some of them quite well. We had not been married for all that long. And so we were always looking for romantic